Well, the middle of May, 1978, the daffodils were up, but spring hadn't yet arrived in Connecticut. Lorraine had planned to spend Saturday the 13th planting flowers in her backyard garden. But gale force winds blew across the state, followed by 5 days of heavy rain. I'm reading from The Demonologist, The Extraordinary Career of Ed and Lorraine Warren, by Gerald Brittle. Too cold in here. Turn the lights down. Make it scary. The weather was a fitting end to a week in which nothing had gone right. In fact, tensions had been building for Lorraine since the beginning of the month. She knew something would soon have to give. With torrential rain beating on the house, the Warrens spent that wet Saturday afternoon planning the itinerary for their upcoming trip to England. Because their work often takes them to the United Kingdom, they've developed an additional expertise in British haunting sites and were therefore booked to lecture on board the Queen Elizabeth II in June. Upon arriving in England, they would spend 2 days in London honoring interview commitments with the BBC, then travel to Yorkshire, Edinburgh, the Scottish Highlands near Loch Ness, and Stonehenge, before returning to Southampton in July to lecture on the return passage. Having made a dent in their UK plans that afternoon, the Warrens went out to dinner in the evening. Arriving home just after midnight, Lorraine reviewed the calls left on the answering machine. There was a message from a friend in Los Angeles. Then a call from the daughter Judy on vacation in Virginia. After that, a young man's request for an appointment with Ed. Then a bizarre series of clicks and odd whirring sounds, followed by the distraught voice of an unfamiliar woman. Quote, "I hope you can hear me. My name is Hillman, Mrs. Jean Hillman. I don't exactly know what has happened here," she said in a barely controlled voice, "but my children have been hit and chased for something. Hesitation. And there is somebody or something in the house, upstairs, in one of the children's bedrooms. Please call me back just as soon as you possibly can." Both Ed and Lorraine listened silently as the distressed woman gave her address and telephone number. Although it was 12:40 a.m., Lorraine immediately tried to return the woman's call. "When a case is referred to us," Ed explains, "now these are very famous Catholic demonologists, laymen, but probably one of a dozen more experienced in dealing with the supernatural, the evil portion, than anybody else in America. They were called in by West Point." Most of my people know this, but there are people watching for the first time. "By West Point to deal with a supposed or alleged ghost by the superintendent at West Point, no less, in the 70s. They were the experts called in on the Amityville horror case. Now here they go again." I was going to say more, but I decided I'm tired of reviewing. "When a case is referred to us," Ed explained, "we immediately contact the individual or family in trouble. If it seems necessary for us to enter the case, then we'll offer to help. We tell the family that we don't charge for our time, but we must be reimbursed for basic expenses, such as airport fare, hotel rooms, and so on. When that's understood, we set up an appointment as soon as possible. Usually, we're on our way within an hour or two. Mrs. Hillman's phone rang continuously, then the connection was broken. Lorraine hung up and dialed again. This time, it sounded as though someone had picked up the receiver, but the phone still kept ringing. The third time she tried the telephone number, Lorraine got the same frustrating response. At a loss, Lorraine dialed the operator, who then dialed the number and met with the very same problem. In turn, the operator summoned her supervisor, who listened to Lorraine's explanation that she was trying to return a distress call. Understanding and helpful, the supervisor ran the call through a number of electronic test procedures, but to no avail. She admitted being puzzled. There's nothing wrong with the telephone on the receiving end. Your call should make a connection. Nonetheless, the Warrens were unable to get through that night. As Ed and Lorraine knew very well, what happened with the Hillman's phone was not unusual. In fact, such electronic tricks are commonplace when a malevolent spirit is at work. Interference, obstruction, confusion, tactics which cause delay, are routine for a determined spirit with the ability to manipulate both physical and metaphysical variables. The next morning, Sunday the 14th, the Warrens drove to church. On the way, now, here I go again. I mean, there's bound to be people listening for the first time, and they're going to think I'm crazy. I don't believe a word of any of this. But it's true. I mean, I think it's all a crock. These things just don't happen. This is out of the Middle Ages. It did. I've read it over and over. I must be in the eighth reading now. I ain't even going to read The Devil in Connecticut. You just read it. Just read it yourself. On the way, a powerful, rank smell of excrement filled their car. Somebody hiding under the seat. Then midway through the church service, the same foul, psychically projected odor assaulted the Warren senses. Once again, as they were returning home in the car, they were nauseated by a disgusting stench. I can't read this stuff. All my credibility in 10 years is going to be destroyed. I want to finish. Ed and Lorraine, however, did not associate it with the demonic case they were about to investigate that afternoon. Well, that makes sense. I mean, that makes sense. At least they're not asking me to believe the unbelievable now. They sure trusted each other. That's all I got to say. When the Warrens returned from church, I want to tell you, if you got a demon assaulting you like that, stay home. Don't you come to King's House on Sunday morning. You just call me up. I'll come out and exercise the place for you. I mean, knocking on wood and all that other stuff, that was scary. This is just plain awful. When the Warrens returned from church, I'm going to keep going. Lorraine immediately telephoned the Hillman family. Mrs. Hillman answered the phone on the second ring. Lorraine told her the difficulty that she had reaching them the night before. The phone was in working order, the woman replied, but it didn't ring after midnight. I know, because I was waiting for you to call. The problem with the telephone upset the women even further, so Lorraine made an appointment to visit the family that afternoon. By 2 p.m., the Warrens had arrived at an address just outside the University of Massachusetts. The Hillman home was a typical Cape Cod house on a wooded plot where Ed and Lorraine later discovered the family had lived for the past 13 years. Isn't it amazing how much of this is New England? All members of the family were present that afternoon. Al Hillman, a plumber, was a youthful-looking 35. His wife, Jean, with whom Lorraine had spoken on the phone, was her husband's age, but she looked drawn and upset. They had not witnessed the phenomena, however. It had been experienced by their three children, Dee, 15, Bob, 14, and Melena, 11, or Melanie. Ed arranged his recording gear on a nearby table while Lorraine asked their permission to walk the house. Now, I've read enough of this to you. You know Lorraine is clairvoyant. When the Warrens are working together, oh, I know, there are people that say, I don't believe in that stuff. Well, I don't either. I mean, you know, don't take it out on me. I don't believe this smell. I just am stunned by the credibility of the reporters. You know, some people tell you something, you're going to take another look at it, even though you know they're lying. This couldn't be true. And so far, this one's pretty tame. It's kind of awful, but tame. I mean, rocks falling on the house, and spooks flying around. This one's just got a bad smell thus far, and a telephone that doesn't work. Most of us have experienced both of those at some time or other. Just we're not so stupid we write a book about it. You know, it'd be nifty if you could blame the devil for everything, wouldn't it? Ed arranged his recording gear. How do you record smells? Ed arranged his recording gear on a nearby table while Lorraine asked their permission to walk the house. When the Warrens are working together, Lorraine will usually investigate the premises clairvoyantly while Ed interviews the family. She'll begin in the basement and work her way up to the topmost floors, stopping in each room of the house. Because clairvoyance is a sensibility like the other five, that I do believe. It is not possible for her to deny psychic input any more than she can refuse to see or hear. That I believe. I want to tell you, I believe Adam and Eve were both clairvoyant. And I think what we call parapsychology can be supernaturally induced and added to, both by evil spirits and good spirits. But I also think it can be a natural trait hidden recessively in the genes until the statistical probability of them connecting in the chromosomes is so rare that they're about as rare as the true clairvoyant. But what we see is an outcrop of senses and abilities that were very natural to Adam and Eve. That I find no difficulty in believing at all. Therefore, if there's a spirit presence in a home, chances are excellent that Lorraine will become aware of it. As she left the room, Ed began an extensive interview. Both Mr. and Mrs. Hillman made it clear that they had not experienced any of the phenomena their children talked about. But I would imagine, Mrs. Hillman said, that this is probably my fault, at least from what little I know about the subject. D has always been interested in the occult, witchcraft, spells, that sort of thing. She has a small library, but none of the books were on conjuring. So last Christmas, I bought her one on conjuring demons as a present. Merry Christmas to you, a Merry Christmas to you. Pull up some little demons. Merry Christmas to you. I mean, that's quite a gift. You give them the conjuring book, and they can just pull things up all year long. I honestly didn't think anything like this was going to happen. Okay, Ed said, turning to Dee, where is this book? Upstairs, the girl answered. It's a paperback. It explains how to conjure something like 75 different demons. It tells the correct ritual and explains the debt you pay if the ritual works. Did you perform any of the rituals? Yes. What demons did you try to conjure? Which ones? She repeated. I don't know. I only did a few of the easy rituals. The ones I could understand and had the equipment for. When I did them, though, nothing happened, so I didn't bother anymore. Sometimes the response will come days, weeks, months, even years later, Ed informed her. Tell me about what happened to you this week. You had trouble, I believe. Twice, said Dee. Who was here when it happened? Bob, Melanie, and me, she answered. The first time was this past Thursday. Dad and Mom went out to their friend's house. We stayed home because we had school the next day. Melanie and Bob were already in bed, and I'd just taken a shower. I went downstairs to make sure the doors were locked. I also turned off the radio and downstairs lights before I went back upstairs. When I got to my bedroom, I heard the water running in the bathroom. I didn't think about it at first, but a few minutes later I went down the hall and saw all the faucets were turned on. I turned them off. Then I heard the radio on again downstairs. The lights were on too. I yelled, "Who's there?" But nobody answered me. Before I went downstairs again, I looked into Melanie's room. She was asleep in her bed. I looked into Bob's room, too. But he wasn't asleep yet. I asked if he turned the radio on downstairs. He said he hadn't. So I then went down and turned off the lights and radio a second time. When I came back upstairs, the water in the bathroom was running again. This got me mad because I was sure Bob was doing it. But when I came out of the bathroom, the radio was on real loud and all the lights were on downstairs. I went into Bob's room and says, "There's someone in the house." "Bob, did you hear the radio?" asked Ed. "Yeah, I heard it, but I didn't think anything about it," he answered. "Did you turn on the water?" Ed asked quickly, hoping to catch him off guard. "No way," the boy replied. "I never even got out of bed." "Okay, D," Ed said. "Please go on." "D, from upstairs, I could hear the radio changing stations. So I went right back down again, thinking my parents might be home. When I got down there this time, the radio dial was moving back and forth all by itself. I stood there and watched it. And that's when I stood there and watched it. And that's when I got down there this time, the radio dial was moving back and forth all by itself. I stood there and watched it. And that's when I started to get scared. I turned off the radio and the lights again. But when I got halfway up the stairs, I felt an icy, cold hand touch me on the shoulder. Just for a second in the dark. I almost screamed, but I didn't. I just went right to my bedroom, shut the door, and turned off the light. Now, why in the hell's carnation did she do that? Before I got to my bed, though, I heard the sound of footsteps, like someone was walking out of my room into the hall. But the door never opened. Well, didn't you think any of this was strange? You had one to know. Sure I did, said Dee. I was scared out of my mind. Melanie, did you hear the radio head ask her? I was asleep, answered the little girl. Now, Dee, did anything else happen after you heard the footsteps leave the room? Yeah, plenty. When I got in bed, I lay down and closed my eyes. Now, what in hell's tarnation did you do that for? When I got in bed, I lay down and closed my eyes. Yeah, plenty. When I got in bed, I lay down and closed my eyes. Suddenly, yeah, plenty. When I got in bed, I lay down and close my eyes. Suddenly. And you know what happened all of a sudden? I do. You will if you call me. Now, I got to find out. I'm on all these new people now. You want me to continue on demonology? Now, Jesus ran into them everywhere he went. He found them in the synagogue. He found them enjoying the breezes around the Sea of Galilee. I'm on the subject of demonology. Long overdue that we take an intelligent look at it. I started with a Catholic demonologist. Now I'm back to him. Can we finish this story?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Suddenly, you didn't think I would. You shouldn't think evil of your pastor. Get you in trouble. Yeah, plenty. When I got in bed, I lay down and closed my eyes. Suddenly, I heard a door downstairs slam real hard. Suddenly, I heard a door downstairs slam real hard. After that, I heard furniture being pushed around and crashing, like it was being thrown by somebody who was very mad. I really thought there was someone in the house, but I was too scared to do anything, so I just kept my eyes closed. But even though my eyes were closed, I could see my whole room through my eyelids. I don't believe any of this. I opened my eyes, but nothing was different, so I closed my eyes again. Then through my eyelids, I saw a silver light come out of the woods and glide into my bedroom. It was there when I opened my eyes, too. The next thing I knew, something, some hand, now if you want me to keep going, you better call. Don't answer at King's House 1, when all the calls right here. If you want me, I'm not going to stay on this subject. I've been away 2 or 3 days. I'm not going to stay on this subject if anybody's going to think I'm nuts. I'm going to deal with this subject only if people listen to everything I say and don't misconstrue what I say. I'm going to get to the bottom of this thing. I can't believe it. This is the most unbelievable book I've ever read. Can't you find this one? We got the other one out of print. Can't you find this book for me? Give me a note how much it costs. I mean, I'm tired of having to finish these stories because people don't believe them. I just let you read it by yourself. Nobody knows you're reading it, then you won't feel foolish. The next thing I knew, something, some hand. You want me to finish?
Yes, sir.
Anybody calling?
Yes, sir.
Answer the phone. Now, Dee, did anything else happen after you heard the footsteps leave the room? Turn the lights down. Yeah. Plenty. When I got to bed, I lay down and closed my eyes. Suddenly I heard a door slam downstairs real hard. After that, I heard furniture being pushed around and crashing like it's been thrown by somebody who was very mad. I really thought there was someone in the house, but I was too scared to do anything, so I just kept my eyes closed. But I've seen buts lead to some terrible things, but this is the worst. It's the worst I've ever seen. But I have to turn you off on butts forever. I don't think I'll read another line. I mean, that's one connecting word should be left out of the English language. It always leads to something terrible. What is that? But even though, you watch, you'll agree with me. Even though my eyes were closed, I could see my whole room through my eyelids. I don't believe this. It's true. It's what makes me mad. I opened my eyes and nothing was different, so I closed my eyes again. Then, through my eyelids, I saw a silver light come out of the woods and glide into my bedroom. It was there when I opened my eyes, too. The next thing I knew, something, some hand, that's where I was. Right there. It was there when I opened my eyes, too. The next thing I knew, something, some hand. Now that's a hand. The next thing I knew, something. Some hand. That's what I said, wasn't it? I don't think I should go on. The next thing I knew, something, some hand. Now, remember in that book, let's see, where is it now? It's here somewhere. I knew I had it. Now, the Pentecostals were laughed at over things like this. Now, this is a Catholic I'm reading about. And poor old Lester Sumrall. Bless his heart, I like Lester. But he had a hard time making people believe this story for a while. The true story of Clarita Villanueva. Remember, we left this story, didn't we? Huh. He tells the story in Manila. It was the tape recorder in the hands of the news reporter mentioned by Dr. Lara that forced me into the story. Oh, you want me to go back to that? I know. I mean, you know, I want you to know your vibrations are getting through. The broadcast of the Clarita interview over station DZFM lasted for 45 minutes. It was one of the most blood-curdling programs I've ever heard. In fact, the only program to approximate it was the drama by Orson Welles called Invasion from Mars. The radio announcer dramatically announced the broadcast as follows. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. If you have a weak heart, please turn your radio off. So everybody called whomever had a weak heart and said, turn it on. I turned the dial of our radio up higher, and instantly there were piercing screams followed by pandemonium. Doctors spoke out of the confusion. This can all be explained. Our records show that this phenomenon has been known before. This is fugue. This is epilepsy. It is extreme hysteria. Other persons were excitedly saying, look, the marks of teeth appear. Another would say, the girl is being choked by some unseen thing. She's blue in the face and there are marks on her neck. Then Clarita would scream again. I turned to my wife and said, this girl is not sick and the doctors are helpless before such an enemy. Her cry is the cry of the damned and the doomed. That girl is demon-possessed. It was impossible for me to sleep after listening to that program. I walked the floor, crying to God to deliver the poor girl in the city jail. The longer I prayed, the heavier the load became. I said, oh God, if the devil's in that girl, you can cast him out. Please do it. After I prayed at length, God spoke to my heart, if you'll go to the jail and pray for her, I'll deliver her. In an unthinking second, I replied, no, God, I can never go to that place. There have been scientists, professors, legal experts, and even spiritualists trying to help that girl, and they all have had adverse publicity in the newspapers. I can't go. Finally, I decided the next morning I would go and pray for the girl. In a city of over 2 million people and in a prison of mammoth proportions of Billaby, it's not easy to get an interview with such a notorious person. On my way to town the following morning, I stopped at the home of my architect, Leopoldo Coronel. He's a personal friend of Mayor Laxon of Manila. At my request, he called the mayor on the telephone for an interview. The mayor was willing for me to pray for Clarita, but he said he personally never wanted to see her again. His one stipulation was that Dr. Mariano Lara, chief medical advisor of the Manila Police Department, would grant his permission. Mr. Cornell, my architect, did not know Dr. Laura, but another friend, Mr. Domingo Sapida, a building contractor, knew him, and he called him for me and requested an interview. This was granted. We arrived at Bilibid Prison and were escorted to the morgue. The first thing I noticed was a cadaver on the slab. The surroundings were eerie. Another corpse was wrapped in a blanket on a stretcher awaiting attention. On a table were a dozen or more jars of spare parts of human beings and alcohol. We found out later they were for student demonstrations. Sitting on a bench in the long, drab morgue, we heard Dr. Laura, a professor and department head of pathology and legal medicine at the Manila Central University and professorial lecturer of legal medicine, University of Santo Tomas, admit that in his 38 years of medical practice, he had performed over 8,000 autopsies and that he had never accepted the theory that there is a non-material force existing anywhere in the universe. But this baffling Filipina girl, being bitten by devils, had changed his philosophy of life. He turned to me and said, "Reverend, I'm humble enough to admit that I am a frightened man." I told him I would be glad to come and pray for the girl if he would permit. The doctor said he would welcome me. Then I requested that no medication be given the girl during the time that I'm praying for her, and that no other groups be permitted to pray for her or offer assistance in any way. If Jesus healed her, he must have all the glory for the same. Dr. Laura agreed. We set the time of prayer for the following morning at 8:30. I had not eaten since the night before, so I fasted the rest of the day and spent the time alone in prayer and reading the Word of God. The following morning, I arrived at Bilibid Prison. Upon entering its dreary walls, I felt like there was going to be a contest between the God of Elijah and the prophets of Baal. Ancient Bilibid, with its centuries of bloody history, was to witness a new kind of battle. Here the Spaniards imprisoned their victims. Here the Japanese conducted uncounted atrocities. Here the American missionaries almost starved until the day of liberation. To say the least, it's an uninviting place to pray the prayer of deliverance. On the first morning, I was accompanied by the architect of our church, Mr. Leopoldo Coronel, a Roman Catholic. With Dr. Laura, I found a professor from the Far Eastern University. When we started walking toward the women's cell block, I saw police officers, newspaper men representing the local and foreign press, photographers, and others. As Dr. Laura and I led the way down the dusty prison road through the barbed wire gates for the sentries on duty, I almost felt as if it was the end of all things. Following behind me was a motley crowd without the slightest idea of what they were going to see. I was the only Protestant in the entire group. By the time we'd assembled in a small chapel for women prisoners, there must have been about 100 spectators, including prisoners. I actually felt that my greatest battle would be with the spectators. However, I found that they were friendly and even sympathetic. Most of them had already seen the teeth bites on the girl. They already saw and observed the failure of the doctors, the psychiatrist, and the spiritualists. But they had never heard prayer for the diseased and demon-possessed. They were of no spiritual assistance to me. The small chapel had steel-barred windows. It had been a very primitive Roman Catholic altar at one end of the room. It had a wooden bunk and a couple of small handmade chairs. Otherwise, it was dreary and barren. After we all gathered in the chapel, Dr. Laura commanded that Clarita be brought in. As the girl entered the door, she observed each person slowly and closely. I suppose she was looking for the doctors who urged her to have the devils bite her again and again. When she came to me at the end of the line, her eyes widened and she glared at me, saying, "I don't like you." These were the first words the devil spoke through her lips to me. They used her lips constantly to curse me, to curse God, to curse the blood of Christ. She did this in English, and yet after she was delivered, I had to converse with her through an interpreter as she could not speak English. After she spoke, I had her sit on a wooden bench, and I drew a chair up in front of her and began saying, "Clarita, I've come to deliver you from the power of these devils in the name of Jesus Christ, the Son of God." Suddenly, the girl went into a fit of rage. She screamed, "No, no, they will kill me." Her body became rigid. She became unconscious. This had baffled the doctors when they tried to analyze her case. But I had dealt with devils before and understood some of their antics, so taking hold of her head with both hands, I cried, "Come out of her, you evil and wicked spirit of hell! Come out of her in Jesus' name!" She immediately began to rage again. This was the first time she had instantly come back from one of the trances. With tears flowing down her cheeks, she begged me to leave her alone. And she showed me terrible marks on her arms and neck where she'd been bitten that moment. I was shocked. There were the terrible teeth marks, so severe that some of the small blood vessels under the skin were broken. Rather than feeling like quitting, I simply forgot that I was surrounded with unbelievers and went into the greatest battle of my life. I have never known anything like it. The devils would curse God, and I would demand them to quit and tell them God is holy. Then they'd curse the blood of Jesus, and I rebuked them, reminding them that He is the master over every evil power, and that His blood is holy. Then they cursed me in the vilest language. They declared they'd never leave. It seemed that the powers of darkness and the power of righteousness were in deadly conflict. I was only the mouthpiece for righteousness. Clarita was the mouthpiece of the devil. No doubt the noise could be heard for some distance in the prison. Finally, Now, I'm just trying to get a simple gestalt across. These are Catholic demonologists I'm reading first. This is a Pentecostal. I've worked with Lester Sumrall. I've preached in his church. We conducted seminars together in San Diego. I've known Lester around the world. I've preached in the church in Manila. I've preached with Lester in Hong Kong. I know his work in Brasilia. In his prime, he was probably one of the greatest missionaries ever to go overseas. I got into a taxi in 1963 in the giant city of Manila and said, "I want to go to the Christ is the Answer Church." Every taxi driver knew where it was. This event built that church. Every newspaper in Manila had carried the story of Clarita Villanueva. And a church was born. The tragedy of the story is the girl began to be exploited after her deliverance. That's why I want to stay on this subject of demonology. People prey on the sensational. And the poor girl, instead of being left alone to just move forward in God, began to be exploited. God used Lester Sumrall in that scene. And the great mark of Lester Sumrall's ministry has been a boldness. Now, one of my quarrels with ministries across this nation is that men tend to not stay in the assignment God cast them in. I've been a teacher all my days. I can remember when teaching was very unpopular. Voice of healing evangelists, miracle evangelists, citywide evangelism of the Billy Graham type was the vogue. Everybody wanted to be a junior Billy Graham or a junior Oral Roberts. But then teaching moved on the scene as God's need, and people that were not called teachers nominated themselves to change with the need and become teachers. Well, the gifts of God are without recall. And nothing is as beautiful as a man in his calling doing what God called him to do. And Lester Sumrall, as a missionary evangelist, was without a peer. He would go into cities, large cities, and God seemed to gift him with finding the power center in that city, and God seemed to gift him with being on the spot to do the thing that would bring a church into existence from which to the outlying areas it would spread. And I will always admire Lester Sumrall for that, for I've seen his work overseas. He too knew a day when the denomination that he was in kicked him out, couldn't contain him. In those days, he was bigger than the denomination itself. Again, as some people find out, I've been in this stream of the church all my life. There are not very many of them I don't know, and not very many of them that don't know me. I've raised money for Lester and his church in South Bend, Indiana. This story is totally unbelievable, but it's true. Now I can skip to the most historic, conservative, evangelical, midstream that you can go. The preface is by Merrill F. Unger, Ph.D., Ph.D. Well, who's Merrill Unger? Well, I got it here somewhere. Down here somewhere. No, there it is. Right in front of me. Who's Merrill Unger? Let's see. Am I boring you? You know, I don't want anybody to think that I'm nuts. Biblical Demonology by Merrill F. Unger. Probably the basic text for evangelical Christians of the kind of Assemblies of God, more Baptists than Assemblies of God. Nice little byline, 2 Corinthians 2:11, that no advantage may be gained over us by Satan. We are not ignorant of his devices. Very few Christians can fulfill that verse of Scripture. 2 Corinthians 2:11. That no advantage may be gained over us by Satan. We are not ignorant of his devices. That's why I'm teaching on this subject. Too many people are ignorant. Who's Merrill F. Unger? Well, when he wrote this book, professor of Old Testament interpretation, Dallas Theological Seminary, Dallas, Texas. Well, that's Jerusalem for the Baptists. Copyright 1952, World Rights Reserve, Scripture Press Foundation, Wheaton, Illinois. Well, that's Jerusalem's printing press. The author, Merrill F. Unger, is excellently equipped to do what is here undertaken. 20 years ago, he graduated with honors from Johns Hopkins University. There's no humor in this. I mean, Merrill Unger is well respected. And after spending some years in teaching and in a pastorate, he graduated from Dallas Theological Seminary in 1940. This he followed by graduate work leading to a Doctor of Theology degree, where he received for which he received magna cum laude in 1945. He also entered the Oriental Institute of the Faculty of Philosophy at Johns Hopkins University in 1944, was graduated in 47, 10 years before I came out of Stanford, with a Doctor of Philosophy degree in Semitics and Biblical Archaeology. No mean accomplishment. After teaching for a year at Gordon College of Theology and Missions in Boston, he became the professor of Semitics and Old Testament in Dallas Theological Seminary. His recent book, Introductory Guide to the Old Testament, won the first prize in the Christian Textbook Contest. Now that's Unger. I mean, you know, if I'm crazy, I'm in good company. He writes the intro to this, and he says, in 45, 1946, when I was doing spatial research for biblical demonology, John L. Navius' classic in Demon Possession was of immense help. One cannot peruse Dr. Navius' account of his experiences with demonism as a Christian missionary in China without being struck by the fact that it reads like a page from the Gospels, where demon possession and expulsion play so large a part in the earthly ministry of our Lord. Today, people in general, even Christians, who profess to believe the Bible, dismiss the demonism of the Gospels and of the Scripture as a whole, as an adaptation to the folklore and superstition of a bygone day, now no longer credible in a scientifically enlightened age. Dr. Nevius' first-hand contact with the rampant evil spiritual forces behind an ancient pagan culture not only proves that demonism of the Bible is not an adaptation to popular superstitions of the day, but is a spiritual reality of far-reaching import in our modern world. In an age of spiritual anarchy, shocking immorality, and general world unrest, scientific advance and intellectual sophistication cannot gloss over the evil supernaturalism at work in our society. The deeper explanation of our trouble lies in the scriptural revelation of sin and the concomitant truth concerning Satan and demons. A work like Dr. Nevius' Demon Possession is ever fresh because it deals with the truth just as valid in our day as it was in the author's day. The publisher to be congratulated in reprinting this volume. It has a message of vital importance to our distraught times and pointing us to the basic spiritual nature of the conflict pressing in upon us and in guiding us in the way of victory and deliverance from our foes. Now, from a Catholic to a Pentecostal to dead midstream in evangelical Christian conservatism. The morning following the baptism of Mrs. Quo, one of the Christians in the village informed my traveling companion, Mr. Leyenberger, and myself that a woman living in a neighboring house who was a spirit medium was then under the influence of a demon and was improvising verses referring to us. We inquired the character and history of the woman and received the following reply. As a demon possession by Dr. Navius. She was in your audience yesterday morning. She has frequently come to our services and was for a time much interested in hearing about Christianity. But she said that she always felt distressed after being at our meetings, and on that account she ceased attending them. There had been a struggle in her mind between a desire to be a Christian and the influence of the demon which controlled her. Between a sense of right and duty and her unwillingness to give up the gains of her business as a spirit medium. She spends her time going about making, or going out about among the villages in the neighborhood, telling fortunes and healing diseases, and in this way makes a good deal of money for the support of herself and family. We were desirous of seeing this woman, especially as her case resembled Mrs. Quo's in the particular of extemporizing verses. After some hesitation and delay, we were allowed to enter. As we approached, we heard the measured cadences of the woman's monotonous chant, which we were told had already continued for more than an hour. Entering the house, we saw her lying on the kong. Her appearance was that of a corpse, the face expressionless. No part of the body stirred except the lips and tongue, which were giving forth utterances with the rapidity and uniformity of clockwork. Everything she said was in measured verse and was chanted to an unvarying tune. The first half of each verse seemed like the meaningless chants heard in Buddhist temples, but the latter half was evidently impromptu and referred to us and the Christian religion and our work as missionaries. Her voice never faltered. She never hesitated for an instant, for a word. The rapid, perfectly uniform, and long-continued utterances seemed to us such as could not possibly be counterfeited or premeditated. Her daughter-in-law, at our suggestion, tried to arouse her, calling her loudly by name. But it seemed like talking to the dead. Her respiration was natural. Her pulse full and regular, the skin neither dry nor moist. Not the slightest evidence of fever or excitement. Her arm, when lifted, fell down again entirely limp. After watching her for some minutes, we went to attend morning prayers with the Christians. On our return, she presented exactly the same appearance. Let me save that one for a minute. Well, time moving on. Will you take my word for something? I could just dangle you with this book, but it's got record after record of demon possession in the Chinese provinces, including some where the demons attack and inflict physical marks on the victims. Now, all I'm seeking to achieve as I cover these things is to point out too much evidence. You know what I was saying about the Bermuda Triangle? Too much going on there to just write it off. You know what I said about the pyramid? Too many of those dates right on for it to be an accident. Too much evidence of these supernatural forces. Oh, sure. There may be a rational explanation for some, and there may be some liars inflating the story in other cases. But I'm showing you a spectrum across the whole religious world, from Catholic lay people to a Pentecostal in Manila to the mainstream of evangelical Christianity to ignore it. I'm going to be nice to you. And these are pretty good stories, too. You say, I don't believe those things. Well, the Bible's full of them. Remember the little girl that went around behind Paul in the city? Paul cast the devil out of her. And the people that were making money off of her soothsaying and divinations started the riot that put him in prison. Those are not, as Unger says, accommodations to the culture of the age. The devil was alive and well then, and he's alive and well now. Then, through my eyelids, back to the demonologist. You didn't think I'd start so close to where I left off, did you? Have a little faith. Then through my eyelids, I saw a silver light come out of the woods and glide into my bedroom. It was there when I opened my eyes, too. You say, are you ever going to take me back to that medium? Yeah. Now, we had a sleeping prophet in America, you know. Edgar Casey. What was it? A parapsychological gift that enabled him, while dead asleep, to give what are called readings, and as people transcribed what he said in a state much like this woman in China, with a remarkable consistency, the prophecies came to pass. And he cataloged previous ages of this earth and previous existences. Now, I want to tell you something. If the Bible's correct, Lucifer and his minions, those in the hierarchy assigned under him, as Michael fits a place in the hierarchy of angels today, and Gabriel another place, not all angels are equal and not all demons are equal. Lucifer took his lieutenants and sergeants and privates, and they rebelled against God. But before that rebellion, Lucifer was in Eden. Before the fall of Lucifer himself, and before this earth was struck with the cataclysm that occurs between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2, which isn't described or referred to. But literally, when Genesis 1 says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, the implication is the beginning was good. Then comes the phrase that can be translated with equal veracity, the earth became a waste and a desolation. This earth was occupied before Adam was ever created. How long, nobody knows. Demons remember those past ages. Now, the question about Casey, is it parapsychological? Was it a spiritual trance with divine help? This will offend the students of Casey, so please don't misunderstand me. I'm just logically naming the alternatives. Or was it a demon force? Not all acts by demons are evil per se on their face when first done. You would never guess that the little girl that was bragging on Paul had a demon. Everything she said was right. And some of the demons that Jesus encountered in the Gospels worshipped him right off. I'm just saying these are mysteries that deserve exploration. Now, I'll go back to that medium to answer the question. But I'm here now. The demonologist, the Gerald Brittle. I closed my eyes again. Then through my eyelids, I saw a silver light come out of the woods and glide into my bedroom. It was there when I opened my eyes, too. The next thing I knew, something, some hand. Now, that's where I was. You want me to continue? No. You look bored to me. Hell with you. Why do I have to read a story if you're not interested? I don't have to read this, do I? I mean, you know. It was there when I opened my eyes, too. The next thing I knew, something. Some hand. Now, you know what a hand is. A hand's a hand. But not just any old hand. She knew it wasn't her hand. And it wasn't anybody else in the room. The next thing I knew, something. Some hand yanked my hair 3 times. Now, I would curl the hair on the nape of your neck. Each time it pulled harder. Until the third time it made my eyes water. Then I screamed. What in hell's tarnation did she wait so long for? Then I screamed and ran into Bobby's room. Bob asked Ed, "Did you hear all the noise downstairs?" "Yeah," he replied. "Why didn't you do anything?" "I was too scared," he admitted. "Good answer," said Ed. "Melanie, did you hear anything?" "Answer, I heard the furniture being thrown around, and when Dee screamed, I went into Bob's room, too." "About what time did all this happen?" Ed questioned. "That's the funny thing," Dee told him. "It was about 10:30 when I got out of the shower, but my bedroom clock was 3 hours ahead. And when I went into Bob's room, his clock was 3 hours behind." "All right, once you were in Bob's room, did the noises stop?" "Everything got even louder," Dee said. "Did you hear any other sounds in the house at the time? Poundings on the walls, voices, knocking?" "No, just doors slamming, footsteps, and furniture being thrown around," Bob said. "Not much. Just doors slamming, footsteps, and furniture being thrown around." "You would have heard a loud buzzing sound as I went through the roof." "What did you hear, Melanie?" "The same thing Bob heard." "I heard what sounded to me like loud whisperings, too," Dee offered. "Could you make out anything?" Ed asked her. "No." "No." "What about the footsteps?" Ed went on. "Did they lead anywhere?" "They went around in circles," said Bob. Dee nodded in agreement. "After you all went into Bob's bedroom, you kept on hearing these sounds downstairs," Ed repeated. "What did you do then?" "We had an argument," Bob answered. "Dee wanted to call the police, and I wouldn't let her because I knew there wasn't anybody down there. If the police came, I figured they might have thought we were playing jokes on them. Finally, we called my parents at their friend's house," Dee spoke up, "but by the time they came home, everything had stopped. All they did was tell us we were hearing things. Because we were tired, they didn't believe us." "Mrs. Hillman," Ed questioned, "have you ever seen or heard anything unusual in this house?" "Mrs. Hillman, no, like I said before, I've never seen anything. The only thing unusual I've heard is the songbird." She paused. "For years, we had a large pine tree outside our bedroom window. A few months ago, we cut the tree down. But every night now, for the past 3 weeks, Al and I hear a songbird singing outside our window where that tree used to be." "Al, did you hear the bird, too?" asked Ed. "Yeah, every night," he replied. "I never gave it any thought, but birds don't sing at night, do they?" "No," said Ed, "not ordinarily." "Well, it turns out you've all experienced something here," Ed summarized. "You think this house is haunted?" "I think so," said Dee. "I think so, too," Bob replied. Melanie and her mother also tended to agree. "Mr. Hillman," Ed asked. "Well, I don't know. I've never been around when any of this kind of thing has happened." Just then, Lorraine came back downstairs, the clairvoyant. She nodded discreetly to Ed, indicating there was a spirit presence in the home. Was said. There was a spirit presence in the home. And then she took a seat at the dining room table. Rather than alter the mood of the conversation, Ed held off asking Lorraine for her impressions until he had the family's statements on tape. You said these phenomena happened to you, or phenomena happened to you twice, Ed reminded the children. What happened the second time? The second time was last night, Bob replied. Only Dee and I were here. Almost exactly the same thing happened as on Thursday. This time, Dee was in her bedroom, and I'd taken the shower this time. When I came out of the bathroom, I heard the radio on downstairs. The stations were being changed slowly, and I yelled down, "Leave that one on." But when I walked down the stairs, no one was there except the dog. He was snarling viciously at something in the room. Now, that was really strange because he couldn't hear anything. Our dog's deaf. Then I remembered the other night, and I ran upstairs and went to bed. About 5 minutes later, the footsteps started downstairs, making the whole house vibrate. And the furniture started being thrown around again. I was scared the first time, but this time I was really scared. "Did you hear it too, Dee?" asked Ed. "Yeah, just like he did. I even yelled out to Bob, 'Do you hear it?' But he hollered at me saying, 'Shut up!' I guess I didn't want to admit it was really happening again," admitted Bob. "When you were in your room, did you see or feel anything unusual?" Ed asked him. "No, nothing." "How about you, Dee?" "Well, the more scared I felt, the louder everything became downstairs. The second time, I also saw a dark, purplish cloud in my bedroom. I could never look at it directly. Only out of the corner of my eye, it kept moving. When that purple ball was in my room, I kept my eyes closed so I couldn't see it. As I lay there, my hands were closed up in tight fists. All of a sudden, All of a sudden, all of a sudden, that's awful. All of a sudden, I felt another hand try to force mine open. It was a really strong hand, like a grown man's. It couldn't get my fist open, so it yanked at my arm and tried to pull me out of bed. It pulled me almost halfway out of bed before I screamed for help. This is the slowest screaming woman I've ever heard about in my life. It pulled me almost halfway out of bed before I screamed for help. Then it... Well, I don't know if you want me to go back to this or not. I went further than I intended to. The goodness of my heart overwhelmed me. Now, I'm not going to finish. I'm back on 56 at 9 o'clock tonight. And I'm here for a while. Now, I could be persuaded to finish this story. Are you getting the point that there's too much going on out there to ignore it? Good. I pray they descend on you if you don't call me. He said, what a cruel thing to do. Well, my Lord, how difficult it is to call me. I mean, whether you believe that I could have any influence or not, it's an awful cheap insurance. Just dial 1-800-338-3030. You want me to go on with these stories or not? Huh? You better call.